50 years after his assassination, President John F. Kennedy's legend endures. Now, author and historian Thurston Clark argues that the heart of that legend is what might have been. Thurston Clark is the author of the new book, JFK's Last 100 Days, The Transformation of a Man and the Emergence of a Great President. His Pearl Harbor Ghost was the basis of a CBS documentary, and his Lost Hero, a biography of Raoul Wallenberg, was made into an award-winning NBC miniseries. His articles have appeared in publications such as Vanity Fair, The New York Times, and The Washington Post. Again, his new book is JFK's Last 100 Days. It's a great pleasure to welcome Thurston Clark to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It's my pleasure as well.
What got you thinking about these final days, these last 100 days, and ultimately that question of what could have been?
Well, what started me off was at the time of Barack Obama's inauguration. People were talking about his first 100 days. And for some reason, I'd written a book about Kennedy's inaugural address, and I was comparing it to Barack Obama's, and I was wondering what happened in Kennedy's last 100 days, because, of course, for most presidents, the last 100 days, they're lame ducks, nothing much is going on. And the more I got into it and did the research, I found out that this was really his great season of accomplishment. Specifically, in 1963, the United States was threatened by two things. One was, of course, a nuclear war, and the second was racial conflict and the inequality between black and white Americans. 2 days in June of 1963, successive days, Kennedy gave speeches that addressed both of these problems. The first speech at American University, he announced he was going to start negotiating a ban on nuclear testing with the Soviet Union, which in fact he did. The treaty was signed just 6 weeks later and ratified in October. And the second was a speech on civil rights in which he finally announced that he was, after 2 years of dragging his heels, that he was sending a civil rights bill to Congress. So in a stroke, he was addressing the two great threats to our nation. And most of his 100 days was given over to getting the test ban treaty first through Congress and also preparing the ground for the civil rights bill as well.
As you write in the book, he was finally starting to, quote, finally beginning to realize his potential as a man and a president. And this is just more than 2 years in office and finding that footing, which is, I assume, very common for a president.
Yes, I think it's not uncommon, certainly. And, of course, Kennedy had one of his great accomplishments was settling the Cuban Missile Crisis without getting us into a nuclear war. People don't at the time. The tapes have now been released in their entirety, and there's been some more research done. And if you listen to the tapes, you'll find that Kennedy was the only one of his advisors on the so-called XCOM who was against a preemptive strike on the Soviet missiles. Even Bobby Kennedy was for it at first. So the nuclear confrontation with Cuba really set the table for what happened in 63. It rattled Kennedy, and it rattled the whole nation. And that's why I think one of the reasons there was so much grief and mourning at his passing, because the American people had gone through this catharsis, this horror of nuclear war. Anybody alive at the time remembers what it was like in October of 62. And then the hope with the Limited Test Ban Treaty, which was the first treaty since the beginning of the Cold War to regulate nuclear arms. There were a lot of other things, too, in these last 100 days. Kennedy proposed a joint moon mission at the United Nations. Huge banner headlines. It's been largely forgotten now. He wanted a Soviet cosmonaut and American astronaut to be the first people to set foot on the moon.
As you write in the book, ambition and real politic had characterized his congressional career and early White House years, that morality and emotion tempered his ambitions during his last 100 days.
Yes, it really did. One of the reasons that he finally came around to the civil rights bill, and also in his speech to the nation, referred to civil rights as a moral issue, which is something that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. had been urging him to do. In fact, the day he gave his speech on the front page of the New York Times, King was saying just this, that Kennedy had to call civil rights a moral issue. Well, Kennedy did. And one of the things that led him there was his horror at the images on television and in magazines of the brutal beating of the black demonstrators in Birmingham, the fire hoses hitting the water from the fire hoses hitting the children. He was affected by this. And he knew if he was affected that there were going to be a great number of other Americans, white Americans, were also going to be horrified by this, and that now was the time to send a civil rights bill to Congress. So there was that, and there was also his horror of a nuclear war, which was not something new. It was something that he had talked about throughout and before his presidency.
You make the point in the book of really looking at June 1963, the two speeches that he gave in that month, one proposing negotiations with Moscow to draft a nuclear test ban treaty, and the other declaring, talking about race, it has no place in American life or law, that this was the pivotal moment. This was a turning point.
Absolutely. You know, I go back, and I mentioned this in the book, I go back, what Kennedy was finally doing was actually what Robert Frost had urged him to do in a poem that Frost was unable to read at the inauguration because the glare from the sun and the snow was so great he had to recite something from memory. 2 days later, Frost goes to the White House. He gives Kennedy a copy of this original poem. And the poem is a challenge to Kennedy to show the same courage that he'd celebrated in his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Profiles in Courage. The last line of Frost's poem talks about a golden age of poetry and power, of which this noonday is the beginning hour. Frost comes to the White House 2 days later. He gives Kennedy the poem. He turns to leave the room, and he looks at Kennedy and said, "Don't be afraid of poetry and power." He said, "It's the formula for another Augustan age. Be more Irish than Harvard." Well, there was a lot of poetry in Kennedy's speeches in the first 2 years, but it wasn't until June of 1963 that he finally married the power of the presidency to the poetry of his words in those two speeches.
I think the last time you were on this program talking about the last campaign and Robert Kennedy and really making the argument that he, too, had in that last campaign had become more introspective.
Oh, definitely. Bobby Kennedy's introspective really it started with Dallas, with his brother's death.
Sure.
And finally, it was in that campaign that when he finally had decided, thrown off all of this hesitation and caution to challenge Lyndon Johnson, that he really came into his own. And I'm glad you brought that up because there was a similarity between the two brothers. They both had a certain measure of political caution before they finally reached in Bobby Kennedy and his campaign and JFK in his last 100 days. Paul Samuelson, who was the economic advisor to Kennedy, once said that, you know, actually he was, for all of this great the Camelot image and everything else, that Kennedy was actually a very timid politician, and he was always checking the ice in front of him for its thickness before he moved forward. Well, I say in the book that finally, in June of 63, and then in the last 100 days, he'd thrown this caution aside, and he decided finally to meet these two challenges. And, of course, by meeting these two challenges, that held out the promise for being remembered as a great president.
I think it's interesting to point out, because as you talk about in the book, and we've heard from many other scholars that we've talked to during this series, that he was such a complicated man and very, certainly one of the most enigmatic men ever to occupy the White House, and could compartmentalize things and was often doing contradictory things. And one of the points you make is that his personal life, what was happening with him and what was happening in his marriage, mm-hmm. could have played a part in this as well.
Yes, the other kind of great important development in these last 100 days was the death of his son Patrick, which was a very traumatic experience, particularly for him, even more so than for Jackie. Boy was born prematurely while Jackie was on Cape Cod. She was supposed to be down in Washington 7 weeks later to have Walter Reed. And it was JFK who spent most of the 36 hours that the boy was alive with him, going with him up to Children's Hospital in Boston and then holding his hand as he died. He burst into tears at the hospital. He cried at Jackie's bedside. And he said to her at one point, we've got to curb our grief. It wouldn't be good for the country or the work we have to do. This made a huge impression on Jackie. I'm using the word we, according to Jackie's mother. And really, there was a shift in their relationship. You know, some people think it's wishful thinking after Dallas to think they were growing closer, but there are really some concrete things that happened. The pictures of them holding hands, which they had never done in public, happened after Patrick's death. Kennedy decided to rent a house in Newport, announce it as a surprise to Jackie at Christmas or after they came back from Dallas. She liked Newport. She didn't like Cape Cod that much, and he knew it was going to please her, and he'd resisted it. So he did that. A number of other things. 3 weeks before Dallas, Jackie turned to a friend and said, I think we're going to make it, referring to them as a couple. She said, I think we're going to make it. She talked about having a real marriage, and then at the end said, I've won. I think I've won. So things were definitely had changed between them. Now, whether that would have continued throughout the rest of Kennedy's presidency, if he'd lived, we don't know. But the signs were that the relationship had certainly improved.
In addressing that question of what might have been, it is impossible, of course, not to bring Vietnam into the equation and wonder what this president would have eventually done about Vietnam. You do point out that in the media interviews that he gave in September and even in early October with both CBS and NBC that give us some insight.
Yeah. Not just that, but the fact that he approved a removal of 1,000 advisors in October by the end of the year with a view towards removing all the advisors by 1965. But look, it's not just that. Throughout his presidency, on I think it's 5 different occasions, he was urged unanimously by his advisors after they had gone to Vietnam and by the Joint Chiefs of Staff to send combat units to Vietnam, not just to have these advisors, but send U.S. combat units. Every single time he resisted, he refused to do it, he sent some advisors instead. Now, the same people, McGeorge Bundy, Secretary of State McNamara, Maxwell Taylor, the Joint Chiefs, Walt Rostow, they were the people who gave Johnson the exact same advice. And the difference was that Johnson took it and Kennedy didn't. I have in the book an exchange that happens between Walt Rostow and a friend on a ski lift in Aspen. Marie Ritter is her name, still very much alive, wonderful lady. And anyway, Walt Rostow turns to Marie Ritter on the lift and he said, I'm doing much better with Johnson on Vietnam than I ever did with Kennedy. Kennedy just wouldn't listen to me.
Mm. The subtitle of the book, The Transformation of a Man and the Emergence of a Great President, where can you make the case for that of a great president?
Well, I say that he was emerging. He wasn't yet a great president. He hadn't been a great president in the first 2 years. Had he solved the two problems, had he been able to do what he intended to do, which was to settle the Cold War and to get his civil rights bill through Congress, I think he would be remembered as a great president. So he was emerging during these 100 days. The whole Cold War thing has been largely forgotten. Dallas, the assassination, is kind of a historical black hole. It swallowed a lot of what was going on. It wasn't just his proposal for a joint moon mission. He was going to sell wheat to the Soviet Union. At the same UN meeting, the British Foreign Secretary, Sir Alec Douglas Hume, told the General Assembly, I think we're seeing the end of the Cold War. A lot of other people made similar comments. In fact, the word détente was frequently used in articles in the Washington Post around this time. So he was moving towards some kind of settlement of the Cold War. That's what he wanted to do. And had he been able to do that, I think that's what he would be remembered for rather than the moon mission.
You write in the book that he intended to travel to Moscow for a summit meeting with Khrushchev, launch a secret dialogue with Castro, explore the possibility of establishing a relationship with China, withdraw 1,000 advisors from Vietnam by the end of 1963, and remove more during 1964. settle the Cold War and the threat of nuclear war, launch an attack on poverty, pass his tax cut, civil rights, and immigration bills, and preside over the most robust full employment economy in American history. That's quite a list.
Yeah, well, that's what he intended to do. Whether he would have accomplished it all is up, of course, we'll never know. We do know that this is a man who accomplished a lot of the things he set out to do. He was the first Catholic president. He set out to be a war hero, and he was. There were a lot of things in a lot of his life is a string of accomplishments. You know, just reading that list, it sounds strange, but, you know, let's just take the war on poverty, for example. Kennedy, with his economic advisor, Walter Heller, had been planning what he called an attack on poverty. Kennedy was very moved by an article in the New York Times about poverty in Kentucky, and, of course, he'd campaigned in West Virginia in the primary, and he'd been very upset by what he'd seen then. For 6 months, he'd been talking to Heller about a anti-poverty program in his second term that they called the attack on poverty. The memos are all there. The day after Dallas, Heller goes to Lyndon Johnson and says, here's what Kennedy planned to do. He was going to call it an attack on poverty. Should we go ahead with this? And Johnson said, yes, but let's call it the war on poverty. So, you know, the Medicare was a Kennedy program as well. If you want to know, probably the Kennedy program that's changed the face of our nation more than any, it's his Immigration and Naturalization Act of 1963, which was passed as a tribute to him in 65, largely through the efforts of Teddy Kennedy. It eliminated the racist restrictions on immigration from Asia. And it's one of the reasons that we've had so many people from the Asian subcontinent and Chinese able to come to the United States. Now, I'm not saying that wouldn't have been revised later or in a different way, but look at the trouble we're having with immigration now. So it's on and on. If you look at some of these Kennedy programs, the Johnson programs, they were essentially Kennedy programs. Not to take anything away from Johnson. I mean, he got them through Congress. Kennedy, it might have been harder. It might have taken him another year. But people forget that the war on poverty, Medicare, civil rights bill, immigration reform, these were Kennedy programs.
Yeah, I mean, you write that the Johnson's domestic legislative program was largely a compendium of President Kennedy's bills and initiatives.
Mm-hmm. And the things that, admittedly, he had trouble, Medicare is one example, getting through Congress. He had gotten his civil rights bill just before going to Dallas. He'd gotten it through the House Judiciary Committee. And, you know, a year later, all four leaders of Congress, Charles Halleck and Carl Albert, majority minority leaders of the House, and Mike Mansfield, Everett Dirksen in the Senate, were all asked a year later, you know, what the article, the title of the article in Look was, what's become of the Kennedy program? And all four of them, to a man, said essentially that Johnson had passed the Kennedy program and that Kennedy would have been able to get most of it through Congress. Now, this is an extraordinary thing for them to say because Johnson was notoriously touchy, and he'd just been reelected, and they had to deal with him. And yet they were willing, Republicans and Democrats, to basically say that Johnson's program was Kennedy's and that Kennedy was on his way to getting it passed anyway.
Mm. With 5 decades of time and being able to look through that context of time, what do you think we should make of this anniversary in viewing this president and his legacy?
Well, I think it's incomplete. I think we should look at what he was trying to do, what he was attempting to do, what he had done on November 22nd, by the time he went to Dallas on November 22nd. And I think that it's important to look at his death and to the reaction to his death in the context of what he was accomplished, was on the way to accomplishing in 1963. I mean, there is a reason that people were so upset at the time, that 57% of Americans admitted crying real tears, that more schools and roads have been named and buildings have been named for Kennedy than any other American president, even Lincoln. There's a reason, and that was, the terror of nuclear war from the Cuban Missile Crisis and the hope that was put on Kennedy's shoulders, that he was the man who was going to make this, that was going to free us from the fear of nuclear war. You know, At the about 6 months, or maybe it was a year after Dallas, Bobby Kennedy said to Jackie, trying to comfort her, he said, well, at least we can be grateful that he wasn't shot after the Bay of Pigs, because then he'd be remembered as the worst president. Now, this sounds like kind of cold comfort, but for people like Bobby and Jackie, who knew how important the verdict of history was to JFK, it was actually very comforting and spoke to the fact that in his last year, he had really begun to cement his legacy, and this was the tragedy of Dallas.
The name of the book is JFK's Last 100 Days, The Transformation of a Man and the Emergence of a Great President. It is published by the Penguin Press. Thurston Clark, thank you very much for spending time with us. A delight, as always, to speak with you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, JFK's Last 100 Days. It's published by the Penguin Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.